Hello, and welcome back to another episode of XY, Season 3, Episode Dos. This week, I'm joined by a gentleman called Max Wilcox, who is an athlete, I guess you would say. A very impressive athlete. He's someone that I followed online for quite a long time. He's someone that I really looked up to in terms of sport and fitness. And the reason I invited him on the show is I actually saw him speak about his mental health on another podcast. So I have just decided to rip them off. But alongside that rip, there is some really good, authentic, original conversation. I don't know, I hope it translates in the show. Because I really enjoyed my chat with Max. I found it really cathartic, really relaxing. And as cheesy as it sounds, if an open road in a desert with a sunset background was a person, I feel like it would be Max. So yeah, I'll leave that one there and let him do the talking. Thanks so much for jumping on the pod with me. We'll keep it super casual, keep it super light. I guess I just wanted to have a bit of a chat with you about who you are, what you do.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about running, because that's something that you do quite well, I'm told. I wanted to have a bit of a chat about how running impacts your mental health and what kind of connection that has to it. It's something that, I've heard you speak about on pods before. Yes. And it's certainly something that links back to me in a big way. And then I just want to have a bit more of a generic chat around some of the stuff that's been going on recently. And that's not stuff I expect you to have answers to. It's more just conversation topics. I'm not going to ask you to solve any problems. But yeah, just straight off the rip, it'd be great if you could say, you know, who are you and what do you do?
Well, hi, I'm Max Wilcox. I am a producer in the outdoor sports, lifestyle and adventure space. And also, for my sins, I've considered myself a bit of an ultra endurance athlete.
I don't think you consider yourself that. I think you are that. I've been on your Instagram. I've seen that endurance stuff going on. You're not going to be the only endurance athlete we have on the show as well. So I'm actually really interested to get into just the mindset of it, actually. In fact, yeah, let's start there with the interview, because there's something about somebody telling me they're running 100 kilometers or whatever that actually sounds less difficult than running a marathon. And the reason for that is I actually can't quantify 100 kilometers. Like the distance in my head, I would never make it remotely near that distance. So the idea of a marathon sounds exhausting, because I know what 15K sounds like and feels like.
Yeah, it's like it becomes unquantifiable, because you're kind of nowhere near ever having had to understand it, right?
Yeah, completely. So like, where do you start with that physically and mentally? You know, like, what's the journey that you go on?
No, it's that's such a good question. I mean, originally for me, I think it was the fact that these things just are seemingly unquantifiable from an imagination point of view. Mm. I think that's the draw for so many people. It certainly was for me. It's like someone walks into a room and tells you that they're going to go and run a 50-mile race, and you're like, I have no idea what that experience would be like. And then someone comes and stands in the guy that comes in after him is like, by the way, like, I'm going to go run a 100-mile race. And you're like, your jaw kind of hits the floor. It's like, holy crap, like that. Like, how do you even relate to these types of distances? And I think that was definitely part of the draw for me. It was like, A, you know, you get to have that conversation with yourself of, we've got no idea what we're doing in terms of trying to run that far. But wouldn't it be amazing to find out?
And is that the kind of starting point for you then? It was the unknown was a bit of an appeal.
It definitely felt that way. Like it felt like the insurmountable challenge in itself was what I was looking for at the time. Yeah. And the prospect of someone saying, like, go and run 100 miles or you know, here's a 100-mile race, like, can you just make it to the finish?
Yeah,
was just such a for me at the time, was just such a great focus and challenge. Like, and I wouldn't necessarily, you know, when people talk about challenges, sometimes they're like, oh, like, you know, I took on this challenge and it was like 6 months of training and da-da-da. Like, it was actually, for me, it was just something that I felt like I could try and make into my lifestyle of enjoying the run, or, you know, the amount of running or the running that I was doing, because of the world that I'd kind of created around me, which was, I enjoyed the not necessarily the solitude, but the personal endeavor of what running is. You know, no one does it for you. And then, so someone says, here's a 100-mile race. Like, you are going to find out some amazing things about yourself, but it's going to take everything you've got. You know, yeah, that seems like a, like, I'd recommend that to anyone.
Yeah. Something that I've always said about exercise and mental health for me is it's super binary. In a really non-judgmental way, you either do or you do not do something. You either kind of succeed in your endeavor or you fail. And again, like, not in a kind of way to like beat yourself up and that, oh shit, I didn't complete that race or I didn't lift that weight or whatever. It doesn't need to be about criticism. It's just the facts. You did or did not do what you set out to do. And something that's that clean cut and simple is actually quite a rewarding space to be in, where you are or are not doing something. You know, you are running or you're stopping running because you can't run any further. It just feels really achievable. It kind of feels doable. It feels really manageable, and it's kind of all on you, so you don't have to worry too much about it. You know,
yeah. I mean, I find it really interesting because, you know, the prospect of a 100-mile race is not the same throughout the whole race. That's what's so brilliant about it. That's what's so brilliant about any like long distance, long time endurance event is your mentality on mile one. You know, the hard facts of a 100-mile race are this. The first mile of a 100-mile race, in terms of how you feel, is going to be the easiest.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, your body's never going to feel as good as it is on mile one. But the chances of you finishing that mile are significantly lower than your chances of you finishing the last mile of a 100-mile race, because there is no way in hell you run 99 miles. Your body feels the worst it has throughout the whole prospect, and you do not finish that 1 mile knowing that it's the last mile. So it's like, and that's what I mean, is like your mentality and the race itself changes as you progress, because you're like, holy crap, I'm 60 miles deep into this. Like, you know, am I a person that wants to say enough is enough? And then you're like, well, I can do 5 more. And then, you know, you get to 65, or you get to 70, you get to 85, you get to 90 miles. Your mentality stood on a 90 mile at mile 90 on a 100-mile race is completely different to standing at mile zero on a 100-mile race. How your body feels is completely different. Yeah. So like, you know, it's, I guess it's, you know, it's the same with.
Did it feel achievable at mile zero? As in at the start line, did it feel like, holy fuck, what am I doing? Or was it, were you psyched for it?
It's brilliant, man. 100% I'd recommend you do it, because I think it's like, it's one of those things where everyone's like, oh, you know, does it feel achievable answering your question? No. Yeah. I don't think you're ever ready to run 100 miles. I don't think you ever feel ready to run 100 miles. Do you feel ready to give everything you've got? That's the question you want to be asking yourself on the start line of a 100 mile race. And that's why I still want to do more of them.
Ooh.
Because like, I'm not, I you know, especially with the last 16 months that we've had, it's like, I don't care whether I do it in like 16, 17 hours or 30 hours.
Yeah.
You know, can I do it is the, like you said, the binary nature of it, you know?
Well, that's a good point. Actually, you're saying 16, 17 hours or 30 hours. What is what's a 100-mile time? You know, what do people do it in?
A good 100-mile time is anything under 24 hours.
Jesus Christ.
And that, if you do it under 24 hours, that would, for 100 miles, involve a little, I'd probably say 60-40 running to walking, right? Like you can walk quite a lot on a 24-hour 100 miler. Start getting down to kind of 17 hours, you're not walking much, and your kind of breaks are 10-15 minutes here or there. Anything when you start hitting the 16-hour mark and under, you're not walking at all. You're running the whole thing.
Jesus
and
Christ.
that is, and then some guy has just set the world record for a 100-mile race that is just like, I think it's like 11 hours something. It's like, that is just, yeah. So And it's amazing because you'll stand on a, this is the thing, right? Someone says, here's a 100-mile race. You'd imagine you turn up at the start line full of this kind of Spartan-esque elite, like, you know, ready to go to war, capes, six packs, spears.
Yeah, definitely.
But you turn up to a start line 100-mile race. It, you know, it's every man and his nan is there, because there are people that are just like, you know what? I've got 32 hours. It's the challenge of walk, running it. And it's the start line is eclectic. You've maybe got on a 100-mile race in the UK, 5% of that field are kind of there to
elite.
Try and, yeah, if that.
How interesting. What do you think it says about somebody that they want to run 100 miles? Like, is it just that original point you made around the unknown, wanting to kind of tap into something in yourself that chases a seemingly impossible venture?
Yeah, it's, again, like, this is why from my production stuff and my interest in creating media around the world, this is why I find it so fascinating, because the conversations you have with these people are just amazing.
I bet.
And the rate of depression in long distance endurance sport is just like, is so much higher than any other sport. And it's the rate of people that have a history of addiction is so much higher. Mm-hmm. And then they get kind of channeled into these spaces. I'm not saying everyone that's on a start line 100 mile is an addict and a manic depressive, but there are people that have kind of found their mm-hmm. calling in being able to commit to the process of and the enjoyment of going out for a run. And yeah, I just like the stories you get on a start line. You know, you're turning up to a 100 miler, Richmond to Oxford. It's dead flat. It's a brilliant race, Centurion 100, that is happening in a few weeks, I think. And you'll go up to that start line, and there'll be tons of you know, 60-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds who are there to kind of just power march for 32 hours or 30 hours or whatever the cutoff is, and it's insane.
And do people sleep? To be honest, I could ask you questions about this all day. I'm rapidly becoming wanting to sign up to one, and I've never. I think just talking to you has got me so motivated. But I'm like, going to get off this podcast.
This is the best thing.
I'm running 100 miles.
I mean, do it because like it just signed, like this is the thing, right? Is I said it, you know, a couple of minutes ago. It's like you're never gonna feel ready to do it, right? You're never gonna feel ready to do it. But you can do it. The hardest part is actually orchestrating your life to say, well, you know, I've got this race in August, you know, I'm gonna have to give myself at least, you know, 5 or 6 weeks. You know, if you keep your training motivated, and then 5 or 6 weeks, you kind of actually put a bit of, you know, kind of like, let's avoid the pub garden for a few weeks.
Yeah. How long do I need to practice for? Which Oxford Richmond, stop laughing, which Oxford Richmond race am I doing? Am I doing 23, 2024?
We could 100% we could do it this year. If we started training now, honest to God, it is such an adventure.
July, August.
I've never been to a 100-mile race, and I've been to some absolutely great ones. I've been out into the Colorado Rockies. I've been out to Western States in California, and witnessed it. I didn't actually get to run that race. And I've some really great races all over the planet. I've run 45 miles down in Patagonia on like almost the southernmost point of the world. But the adventures you have along these runs, and the conversations you have, and the misery that you have, it's just brilliant.
Is that misery? I guess there are points in the race where you think this was a mistake, or I can't finish here.
Yeah, I think this is it. Right? With everything, the scope of your scope of your achievement kind of comes from the depth of your kind of suffering to get to that point. everyone has difficulty in their own way, right? Or their own challenges within doing these things, or, you know, self-doubt, or whether it's just pain and agony, or whatever it is. And Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I think you find out so much about yourself. I think that's what, I don't necessarily think that's what people are searching for. They're not like, it's not like, you know, just, it's not like going to take peyote in the desert or anything mm-hmm. like that. You know, it's, that would be a significantly easier way.
Yeah, that sounds like a different holiday.
Yeah, I mean, but then, you know, you do get the hallucinogenic kind of complete fatigue of just being moving for 24 hours. And it's,
yeah,
and you get the camaraderie and like someone, if someone offers you the world's worst ham sandwich whilst you're 70 miles into a race and it's pitch black at 4 a.m, freezing cold, you're just so grateful to that person.
You'll take it.
Not only that, you're like the person that's handing it to you is godly. You're just like, you are my favorite person.
Thank you for saving my life.
Yeah. But where do you get that gratitude from in real life, right?
Yeah. Do you know what? I think that the hilarious thing is that I was about to say, like, oh, I know what you mean there when you were talking about the depth of your misery is kind of relative to that feeling of success. Because in a very different league, I PB'd my 10K max at the weekend. Yeah, I got it.
That's so good. What was the time?
45 minutes, 12 seconds, which I was quite happy with. I've been trying to get it under 40 for the last year. And this is me slowly dialing back the clock.
Yeah.
Nice. That felt pretty tough. And that's in a completely different realm.
Yeah.
But it was the point you made around the first mile versus the last mile, the first kilometer. I effectively convinced myself that actually I wasn't going to beat my previous PB that was a fortnight earlier. And it was in the last kilometer that it became entirely achievable, because it was like, well, you're not going to not finish because you didn't want to run a little bit faster. You know, you probably are going to beat that.
Yeah. I mean, the 10K, like shorter distances, 10K distances are like, it's a different kind of suffering, and it's a different kind of, well, for me, I feel like it's a different kind of internalization. Like I might have to readdress our scope for how long it's going to take for us to train for the 100 miler, but you know, we'll now that you've said that, but that's all good. Maybe we are looking 2023,
and that's a good time. Like that's a nippy 10K for the average Joe. Okay, but
yeah,
10K in 45 minutes, just north of 45 minutes. When am I running my 100 miles? When's the?
I still think you could do it. I mean, you could do it this year. The thing is you can walk so much. So my first 100 miler, I didn't have a Scooby Doo what I was doing. Right, yeah. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I was smart enough to sign up to a 50 miler prior to doing a 100 miler, but they were like a month or two apart. So I went from kind of never really having run a marathon to like marathon 2 months later, 50 miles, 2 months later, 100 miles.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what I was doing. I just didn't want to stop moving. And you know, it's the middle of the night. I was a 30-year-old man or 29-year-old man with my mum in a car park at 3 a.m. handing me sausage rolls.
Brilliant.
and that was it. So like, I mean, if you know, I think that's it. It's not necessarily can I do it, it's do I want to do it? And that's the question that will plague you as you do these things, because you might get to mile 50, 60, 70 and be like, I can do it, I just don't want to do it. And then you might not finish.
You know, I've got a friend who listens to the show, and he's basically the first person I text with these crazy ideas of, I've just had this thought, I think we should do this. And I can already tell that as he's listening to this, he knows he's going to get a text message retroactively. So by the time he's listened to this podcast, I'll have already sent him the text message.
Yeah, almost as if it's your own, like your own.
Yeah, totally. I've come up with this great idea. I think we should run 100 miles from Richmond to Oxford in 2022. I think we should like work towards that.
Do you know what? Like the thing is though, that Richmond route, right? So 1 year, I don't know. This is some of the dumb crap I've done, right? Is some there was a race organizer down in the southwest who would called Endurance Life that was trying to figure out a way. And this was like 10 years ago, probably even more.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out a way to create more revenue. So what they did was they put little trackers on certain national paths around the UK. I think they had one on the South Downs, one on the Thames Path, da da da. Pay your 10, 12 quid. Like it's so you basically had an unregistered, unsanctioned race with yourself, was that you could just dib in and like every time, and because these national trails are like, you know, some of them are like 150 miles long. So I was like, do you know what? This sounds quite, you know, there is some bravado to being the person that's run a distance the fastest. Mm-hmm. Like I always kind of, it's not necessarily why I do it, but I've always kind of enjoyed it. You know, it's why.
Yeah, of course. Like who wouldn't, like you don't compete because you don't want to win. Like, that would be.
Yeah. So they set one up on the Thames Path. It started at Sheen Bridge. I mean, literally, you are looking for what is effectively the size of a coffee cup, like taped or strung to a tree or a lamppost, like with, and all it has is like a sticker on it. So like half your time, you're actually, you know, most of endurance long distance running is actually navigating and trying to figure out what you're doing, not necessarily moving.
Yeah.
So I woke up at like, I want to say it was like 2:30 in the morning, like 5 days before Christmas, and just ran from Sheen Bridge. Like I got a cab there in the morning. Didn't have Uber at the time. Cab dibbed in on this thing. Worked my way down the Thames Path from 2:30, from about 3:30 in the morning, to Henley, which is 50 miles. A couple of days before Christmas to get home, and then I just gave my mum a call and was like, can you send one of my brothers to come pick me up? Clap. They're like, no, get a cab. That's my family's approach to what I do.
You made this mess. You can sort it out. What do the brothers do? Are they Olympic rower and Usain Bolt? Is it that kind of?
None of my family really kind of gravitated towards the sporting space. My whole family worked together. Like my two brothers, my mum, my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law, my other sister-in-law, they all work in the same, they built a business, they do their thing. And like, I'm the one that sits outside of that doing mine.
That's amazing.
It's really cool. It's really nice. I love watching it. I love seeing them do it. And I love supporting them when they do it. They've never understood the sport, especially the endurance sport thing.
There's probably a separate podcast and a separate chat about why that is and what prompted you to break the mold, but we'll save that for a different day. I think I wanted to tap into a comment that you made, not in a podcast or in an interview or anything like that, but actually when we were chatting about my brand Nice Starts, and you said something about how you fell back in love with running. What is it about running that made you fall in love with it? What does it do for you as a person?
Oh man. I mean, I have no idea how, I always say it like this. I say running found me. Like I didn't find running found me, because the journey that I've been on, I can look back to being 17, 18, living at home in the summer holidays and just being like, I'm going to go for a run. Like where does that come from, right? Like no one, like I wasn't, social media wasn't a thing, you know. I'm 38 years old, that's 20 years ago. Like it's not like I'd watch running on TV and be like, oh, like it's not like Wimbledon, right, where you watch Wimbledon and everyone goes and buys a tennis racket. I would just in the summer I'd be like, do you know what, I'm gonna go for a run. I wouldn't know why. And this is the interesting thing, I'd run for 2 hours, like slowly as hell, like, because I didn't know anything about running. I just knew that I wanted to go for a run as a 17-year-old. And bear in mind, I was a professional sport. I was a professional rugby player. Like that was my space. Like I had no means, need, or service to run for an hour and a half or two hours.
You just wanted to.
I just had a, like, do you know what? And I enjoyed it. I just the mind space of it, the connection to myself, like how it would make me feel, was just huge for me. And it had nothing to do with a competitive nature or wanting to train for something. It was literally, so this is why I just say, like running definitely found me. I got no idea how I ended up doing it, but then it kind of grew. And then, you know, I kind of came back to it a few years later when some buddies were just like, oh, we're going to go and do this race. And I was just kind of always up for a challenge. And then
so cool.
Yeah.
So how does it tie into, you know, the kind of maintenance of your mental health? What kind of role does it play in that, if any?
There has definitely been a time when the running side of my life has kept my oscillation, like my mental oscillation, where it needs to be. And what I mean by that is external stimulation, like this is something I can say retrospectively, like at the time, like I wouldn't have been able to say any of this. I'd just be like,
you're
living in London, all your mates want to go out partying, you kind of don't really want to, but you kind of do it, you know, you have your nights out and, you know, you have your girlfriends or your, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there's just so much stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And the running and the solitude and the fact that it was on my own, the fact that it was for me, the fact that I just gravitated to it, like, but hard. And, and I did most of my running. And this is the thing that I think kind of made a lot of people just think I was super weird, was that, I did all my running down at Barnes Running Track. So it wasn't like most people think, oh, like running's the experience of like seeing things and da 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 and taking in your surroundings. I was running around a 400 meter loop.
Wow.
But for 2 hours, because I enjoyed it, because I enjoyed the process of it. I enjoyed being able to just like, so
fascinating.
So for me, it was literally the fact that because I was going around that 400 meter loop, I didn't have to worry about stopping. I didn't have to worry about a traffic light. I didn't have to worry about someone. Da, 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 da. Like the number of miles I put in around Barnes Running Track, because I gravitated to just being able to move and the process and da, 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 and how it made me feel was phenomenal. And I would always, like, if I could, I'd buy a garden with a 400 meter running track in the back of it.
That's kind of knocked me for six. That the idea of just going around a running track for 2 hours, like that's pretty.
Oh, 2 hours was nothing. Like
that's amazing. Like there's something quite, I don't know, like hypnotic about it, or yeah, therapeutic. Cathartic. There's something very like, when do you stop? Like once you've been going, like how do you know when to just, you know, like
it was so cathartic for me. So yeah. Cathartic. Because you didn't have to, you know, and that's the thing, is like everyone runs for a different reason, right? And I was just like, well, the reason I like running is for how it makes me feel. And for the fact that, you know, it's the movement and the sensation and the way that I'm breathing and the space I get and the fatigue I get and the thoughts I have once I get tired. I was like, well, I don't need to run in crazy places for that. Mm-hmm. 'Cause if you do like 70, 80 miles a week around London, you're running the same routes anyway. So like my idea was like, you know, even if I'm running up and down the Thames every day, I'm still usually pretty much the same part of the Thames. So why not just shorten it to a 400 meter loop, be able to enjoy it. And also, you know, there is the benefit of being able to stop at any point you want.
Yeah.
So, but then there was the mental challenge of having to keep going as well, because you can stop at any point you want. So it's like that juxtaposition of like,
do you listen to music when you're running, or do you just go?
Yeah. Nowadays, like I wouldn't really leave the house without a Spotify playlist but you know, I've done it all. Like I've done the podcasts where you just run for hours listening to podcasts and around the running track. Like I used to love that. And I wouldn't really listen to music that much around the running track, because, you know, I think for me, like the music helps you connect to the environment and the sensation and da da da. Whereas the running track, the environment didn't really change. So, I did a lot of miles with no music, no podcasts, just running around the track, because and then, like I said, like you can stop at literally any step and be 200 meters away from where you started. Or alternatively, you know, you have to keep going every time you pass that 400 meter point. So I loved it.
I guess like I read something about how it was an ex-addict talking about how they've kind of, I guess, in a relatively unhelpful attack on someone's character, you can say, well, you've just replaced your addiction to drugs with your addiction to running. And this recovering addict was saying, well, yeah, maybe I have, but this new addiction that I have is actually really good for me and makes me happy and leads to really positive relationships in my life. So is there actually a problem with this addiction? Like if that's what it is, maybe I am just an addictive person and I now get high on running instead of heroin, but is that a problem? Like, how do you feel about that? Do you think that it is an addictive like lifestyle? Or
I think that is interesting, because I think the connotation of that is like, are you thinking about running when you're not running for prolonged periods of time? And it probably has taken me a while to have like you know, 3 weeks or 2 weeks where I haven't run, where I don't necessarily kind of feel that sense of guilt for not having done it, which is why when you were like, oh, like introduce yourself, it, you know, that imposter, that sense of imposter syndrome is, it will always be there, because like, if I'm not out, if you literally didn't, if you literally, you'd have to literally ask me that question whilst I'm out racing like a 50 mile race to be like, yeah, I'm an endurance sport athlete, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, I'm just like, oh, well, you know, I've done like 800 miles this year on Strava. Like, that's all right. But, which is mental, right? Yeah. And otherwise, but that's it. And yeah, I think you can replace these sense of these kind of addictive personalities, and or at least direct them. I think the hold on you kind of does change though over time.
What you said actually made me think about it in a totally new way. The first thing you said around, do you think about it when you're not doing it? You know, like, is it kind of all consuming? And maybe it is. Maybe you, not you, but one, couldn't be addicted to running in the sense that when they're not running, they just can't wait to hit the track again or hit a trail again. But that's still a relatively healthy addiction. And there's also a thing for me around, well, do you need to solve that problem? Like, is this hurting anyone? It's not hurting them. It's not hurting anyone else. If what they want to do with all of their spare time is clocking miles on Strava, cool.
I've been having like a really interesting conversation with a buddy of mine recently, which is I don't know, this probably isn't the best way to label it, but it's like I'm tired of like the bottom of the barrel mentality. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, talking about kind of recent relationships, it's like, you know, we riff about everything. Like, there is nothing we don't talk about in terms with our friendship and the relationships we have with women and life and work. And, you know, often as is the way, when someone, you know, if a relationship falls apart, and we'll have this conversation, and the conversation will turn towards like, basically like, yeah, I can't believe she did that, or at least she did that, you know, and this is just anecdotal, right? Just, you know, mm-hmm. at least she took the time to message you. And I was like, I'm so fucking tired of this bottom of the barrel mentality of like, at least someone did something. And that kind of sense of like, you know, it's better than being, you know, an addiction to running is better than the bottom of a barrel crack addict in a, do you see what I mean? Like,
yeah, I do.
I don't try and gravitate towards that, because like,
that shouldn't be your baseline. Yeah.
Yeah. That 100% is like, the baseline shouldn't be like, you know, completely addicted to an amphetamine that by virtue of taking it is addictive. Yeah. You know, and I understand that the connotations of the stimulation that your body provides you when you do exercise, you know, because and this is interesting. This is a little segue. I mean, I feel like I said my piece on that, but a little segue. I had a friend who was a doctor at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. And she said, she was like, Max, I'm doing like a pain study. Do you want to come in and we'll kind of put you down as like, because you do like athlete-y stuff, we'll put you down as like a bit of what's it called? Like someone that's an outlier for the test. Like, you're just not a normal person. And so I go in to do this pain study, and it's all dumb stuff, like, you know, putting one hand in ice water and then putting like a slowly warming piece of metal on the other arm. And when you register what would be pain, because of the relativeness of, you know, of something that's really cold and hot, like, you feel it different, right? And I was chatting to the guy that was actually running the study in the department, and he was explaining to me that the concept is usually that endurance athletes have a higher pain threshold. You know, the idea is that these people that can go out and do these amazing things have like this insanely high pain threshold. And he goes, it's not actually true. It's what we tend to find is they're more in tune with their body, like a ton more in tune with their body. And then what they actually do is they realize they're in pain a lot earlier because they're in tune with their body. And effectively what they end up doing is releasing serotonin, which is an incredibly calming, a calming drug for your body. sooner. And then, so what we end, what we have actually found is that most endurance athletes are just serotonin junkies. Like they are kind of chasing that, that bigger serotonin hit rather than, so it's interesting that the idea that these athletes are like, just so like impervious to pain, but the reality is that they feel it so much easier, but they just want more of it.
Yeah. And their body's actually putting them through less pain because of the process that they're going through, I guess.
Yeah, because they're so much better at coping with it, yeah.
How fascinating. And you said that was a study that you participated in.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I so it was the guy that was running the study, this kind of like, it, what, that wasn't the actual study, but he was telling me like as we were going through his kind of pain study.
Amazing.
Which I thought was super interesting.
I mean, I think that for me, exercise in a very different degree to you has always been a part of my life. But I've never been, I was never the football player. I've also never been the guy that enjoyed going to the gym and having like a chest day, you know, like that's not me. But it's more of a barometer for me. I think the times in my life when I have stopped exercising, it's never been like a conscious thing of I'm going to stop working out, I'm going to stop running, I'm going to stop doing whatever. But those are definitely the times when kind of depression's been at its worst. Versus the times when I feel really motivated to exercise, those are the times when actually the rest of my life is going well. So I do, presumably I do exercise to maintain my mental health, but actually it feels like I'm not conscious of that. It's a retroactive realization that, oh shit, yeah, like back then when I wasn't exercising, actually that was a pretty rough time in my life. Whereas now when I'm exercising loads, yeah, things are a bit better at the moment, actually quite happy. And I feel that that's probably a relatively shared thing amongst most people, you know?
It's like putting the horse before the cart, isn't it? Like you're not really sure.
Mm.
Like, do you feel good because you're exercising? Or do you, conversely, do you feel bad because you're not exercising? But like, 100%. And this is actually something I talked to about my, I have a small little run community that I help just have conversations with and guide through and provide little training plans for. And one of the biggest things we actually talk about, or I like to talk about anyway, is our sense of expectation and what we expect from ourselves. I think that's exactly it. I'm the same. Like I feel if I'm not exercising, I kind of feel horrible. And I'm like, well, I kind of know that if I exercise, I would feel better, but I'm feeling horrible and I don't want to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's and so then if you kind of narrate your way through it, like I then start talking about expectation. And I was like, well, what do you consider exercise? Because we kind of get caught up, like anyone, especially in the running world that you will talk to, if they pick up an injury and take, you know, 2 months off or a month off, their last memory of exercising is when they were probably the fittest, because mm-hmm. they've trained, got fit, picked up an injury. So their concept of exercise is being able to do, you know, like for yourself, right? Your concept of exercise now, if you had to take 2 months away from running, would be to do a 45-minute 10K. Mm-hmm. When in reality, you've done that once. And I'm questioning the validity of that timing anyway.
Well, you're questioning the validity of that timing.
Yeah. I'm going to need a screenshot. I'm going to need a watch shot.
you don't think I've made that happen? 45 minutes, 12 seconds was the actual thing. So no, I've not broken the 45-minute mark. 45 and 12 was the
that's the thing. And if you had to take 2 months off running now and someone was like, oh man, like, you know, like how's your running going, you'd be like, oh, like, you know, I had an injury and I had to take some time off, but I was doing 10k in 45 minutes, wouldn't you? That'd be your narrative.
So
then when you come back to it, you're like, ah, oh, I'm really far from that, when the reality is, you know, you've done it. Like, and I think that's what some people struggle with. So
yeah, you're right.
I struggle with.
No, you're so right. And actually I do that in a really micro capacity as well, where if I've had a really good week of eating clean or exercising and training or whatever, and then all of a sudden I have a chocolate bar, I think, well, now that you've done that, you may as well just eat whatever you want for dinner. And actually the workout tomorrow morning probably doesn't need to happen anymore. I actually have a beer because you've already fucked today anyway, so let's just call today a write-off. Which inevitably impacts the next day. And then you think, well, I'm further behind than I was now, and it's compounding. But yeah, it's expectation, I guess. You used an analogy of an injury and I used a chocolate bar. One's
different. Yeah, I mean, they're both relative, right?
But yeah, like, one of them is your own fault, though. Like, you can avoid the chocolate bar. You can't necessarily avoid the injury.
No, but you can't. I actually don't think you can avoid the chocolate bar. That this is my. I do. I mean, yes, you know, that's a bit existential. But, like, I mean, are you eating this chocolate bar? You know, when you're buying the chocolate bar, are you hiding it from the cashier and like pretending it's for someone else? You know, are you then eating that in your car on your way home so that other people don't see you eating that? Like, I know what you're saying. You know, perhaps. You know, there is so much more to the worlds that we live in that that kind of shape how we feel about the environment that we're kind of faced mm-hmm. with, which is like, I'm the, you know, that sense of, you might not necessarily meant to kind of go into it in too much, but, you know, eating something and breaking a diet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's there's tons around it that definitely resonates with me. And I think it's really interesting, you know, the concept of, like you said, like
I don't know anyone, and I'd actually love to hear what you have to say in it, but I don't know anyone, and I actually mean that, I don't know anyone that has a healthy relationship with food, if I'm being totally honest, because like I certainly don't. I don't have any eating disorders, and I certainly haven't losing sleep over it, but it will be a daily thing of, should I eat this? Do I want to eat that? How many calories is in this? Should I get a takeaway? I really want a burger, but oh, that's like such a dirty meal to have. That's fucking so unhelpful and so unhealthy. And I think most people, yeah, everyone I know has a similar relationship with food, which isn't helpful. It doesn't actually add anything to your experience of life.
Yeah. I mean, I find food's like a really, 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 really kind of sensitive subject. Cause I think the worrying thing about the world we live in is that if you or I talk about food, everyone suddenly feels like we're kind of God's derived kind of narrative person for talking about how people should eat food, when that's absolutely not the case. Right. Yeah. yeah. But so I kind of find the kind of conversations about eating disorders fascinating, because obviously, like you said, there aren't that many people that, if you kind of sat down with them, who don't have eating disorders. I mean, I'd actually invite you to come meet my brothers, because it seems like they're golden. Like they are. It is the last thing they don't worry about it at all.
Yeah, around
whereas, it. Yeah. Whereas me, like I'm like the other end of the scale. Like, you know, so to the point where I remember one Mother's Day, I went home and to see my mum, and my older brother was there, just me, my mum and my older brother. And because I'd gone home, it was near this place that I grew up training, which is a series of steps. And it is like 180 steps, double steps, massive thing, I would run up and down it. And I remember that I'd recently separated with a girlfriend. So this is obviously where the whole thing kind of, the mental stimulation that, whatever it was, the turmoil in my life, I'd never done it as many times as that. I did 24 series. It probably took about an hour and 40 minutes of just continually going up and down these steps. It's horrible. Like, it's horrible. And I hadn't really eaten much in the morning. So I get back to my mum's house to have Sunday lunch with my brother and my mum. And there's a big rib of beef on the side, and I'm like, look, I'm absolutely starving, do you have anything to eat? And my mum's like, no, we don't have anything else in the house. She lives on her own, like she doesn't prep for super hungry kids to come home.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, can I just get like a little slice of the beef to, like, because you know, we're gonna have, like, when's lunch? And she's like, 40 minutes. I was like, I just can't wait that long, like. And and it literally, it got to the point where my brother was like, he was like, no, don't touch the beef. And I was like, no, I need something to eat. Like, I am, I've just done an hour and 40 minutes of running up and down the steps, like destroying my soul, because I feel horrible about, I didn't say this, but like, you know, the relationship that had just failed a few weeks before. And and we ended up fighting, like physically fighting, at the ages of 32, 33. And I went and cried in the shower, because I was so hungry, so like emotionally charged through having done this process of what is effectively my coping mechanism of running up and down steps, and then being told I can't have food when my relationship with food is so horrible. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know, it was, like, you know, And yeah, like it, these, I mean, they are just traumatic occasions that you don't really kind of really, but it's interesting because like, I think, yeah, like if my relationship to food wasn't quite so delicate or intricate, then it might not have been so much. But
I think it's, to be honest, that even just you talking about that, for a lot of people, I reckon it'll be quite leveling, like quite actually like a relief. People will, yeah, feel relieved listening to that, because eating disorders, we've spoken about it on one of the first episodes I did actually with James McVeigh, where he spoke really openly about men's relationship with food and eating disorders. And it's something that is just still not a de facto expectation of guys. There's this kind of belief, I still think, that when it comes to mental health, I think one, when it comes to mental health, eating disorders aren't part of that puzzle. You know, they're a separate thing. But secondly, that they're a female issue, you know, and that guys don't have very difficult relationships with food. But yeah, I can imagine why that scenario for you was so triggering, you know?
Like and it's the interesting thing about it is that I was wanting to eat. That's the interesting thing, is that people see eating disorders as being, you know, perhaps trying to avoid certain foods or feeling guilty for eating certain foods. Like my, you know, and I definitely get that in much the same way that it sounds like maybe you do, right? It's like you understand, or sorry, not that you understand, you have this mental connotation in your mind that a chocolate bar is effectively the devil.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's why that particular story for me was quite so harrowing, because for someone that can be so conscientious and shamed themselves about eating certain foods, you know, like even to the point where, like you said, on a Monday, if you eat something that doesn't fit into the idea of what is your perfect diet, your whole day is, you know, is screwed. And
yeah,
and then so that's why that particular instance was like, do you know what, like that was, you know, the food that you were meant to be, that you'd kind of allowed yourself to cover, that was then taken away from you because the potatoes weren't ready or something. I don't know.
I'm getting stressed. Just
Man,
but, I mean, don't want to keep you. I don't want to keep you too much longer. It's been fantastic chatting. I thought we'd chat for kind of 20-30 minutes. We've been on nearly an hour now. I feel like after the pod's over, though, I'm definitely going to hit you up for some more running stories. You've got me a bit jazzed on this 100-mile thing. Let's see if it sticks. If I wake up tomorrow and I'm still feeling psyched for it.
We'll do it again next week. I'll give you more. I've got tons of them. Like,
yeah, the running. We'll just have a side spin-off of the XY podcast, which is just about Max's running tales in Patagonia. That's a good show, actually. I don't know why someone wouldn't listen to that show, to be honest. Like, I'd listen to that show. You should have your own podcast.
Oh, it doesn't stop there. There's like, yeah, I think like the bottom line of it is like I always gravitate back towards running,
and love
in
it.
the same way that I consider myself an artistic, creative person, and I guess like running kind of sits as my muse, if you will, because the thought processes I have, like I just love it, and that's what kind of keeps me coming back. And like I said, the mental oscillation of my mind just kind of calms and smooths, and it's not quite so like crazy.
Less hectic.
Yeah. Which, like, why wouldn't you prescribe that as a,
as a treatment,
as a cure all, right?
I can relate to that. Buddy, it's been absolutely amazing chatting to you. I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll speak soon.
Cheers, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, buddy. Speaking of it.
All right.